and fly out in the sun. You know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun.
Well, get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we have a number of topics of relevance of the past week. First of all, I want to pick up where we left off on this trade war and talk a little bit more about that with some figures that may be of interest to listeners. Also want to point out that we have a growing fragility in the global economy, as I've been arguing for some time. And we'll talk about some indicators of that, particularly coming out of Japan. And then a little bit about the U.S. economy and some indicators that, this big Trump boost to 3 to 4%, I predict is going to sharply slow down here in the next quarters. In fact, we may have in the next six months a quarter of maybe barely 1% GDP growth. Well, that'll prick that bubble of optimism. And then we want to talk about total debt, U.S. debt, because this is the week of the 10-year anniversary of the infamous Bear Stearns investment bank crash in 2008 that sent us on a fast track to the general banking and financial crash a few months later. What was Bear Stearns? And what does it signify? And where are we today, 10 years after? And then finally, a little bit about disappointment of this fellow Kudlow to take the council chair, Council of Economic Advisors chair here, or the economic council that the Gary Cohn is leaving. You know, all the sane ones that were brought in, forced into Trump's cabinet here when he first took office are being chucked over the side of the ship by Trump. As Trump listens to his more nationalist right-wing conservatives here and starts repopulating his cabinet with those folks. I think a lot of it has to do with this meeting that occurred last week, or the week before last, which didn't get much attention in the press. But Trump met with his America First friends. This is the coalition of these nationalists of all ilk together. And they had a meeting in Washington. And Trump met with them. And they jointly planned to raise $100 million for him for his reelection. You know, Trump is on a reelection mode. That's all he cares about right now. Everything he's doing is pandering to his base and preparing for reelection. This guy doesn't want to govern, but he wants to play at president. He wants to be the president, and he likes all the attention and adulation that he gets and the campaign trail, so he's going back there. Everything he's doing, it's like, you know, all these meetings around the country he's holding and speeches he's given to his base, I think is a harbinger of two things. One, that he's back in the election mode already, raising money. And it's also, I think, his mobilization of his base as Special Prosecutor Mueller gets closer and closer to him and an indictment comes down. But the indictment, I predict, will be preempted by Trump as he'll fire this guy, Mueller. And Mueller will get the goods on him, particularly all the shady wheely-deely deals between Trump and the Russians and the oligarchs over there before the election. This isn't an issue of a collusion after the election. This is an issue of all his deep ties to Russian financial interests before the election and funneled through the money laundering bank, Deutsche Bank. That's what this is all about now. And when they find out that, it's going to be a very interesting revelation. But I think he's going to fire Mueller before that happens. And will Congress do anything? Impeachment? Is this 1973? Richard Nixon? Nope. Nope. They won't do a damn thing. They'll just let it go. Because he's delivering for them. See, he gives them a big $5 trillion tax cut. And he's been delivering on a whole host of things, agreeing to it. Delivering in a sense of not opposing it. I mean, he's not doing much to get these things passed. He's just letting his Congress, his Republican and right-wing House of Representatives, Congress, pass it for him, you see, and he's not stopping it. Obama was an obstacle. Now Trump isn't. But in the meantime, Trump gets to play at president and gets to play at running his campaign again. And that's the picture, and all the quote globalists, as he calls them, but you know, the traditional elite who were populating his initial cabinet to keep him in check, they're gone. They're going or gone. You know, he fires without even telling him. He fires Tillerson while he's off in Africa. You know, that's interesting. And then Gary Cohn. You know, the rats are leaving the ship. But that's dangerous in the sense that it leaves Trump with even less checks and balances on him unofficially, internally, and makes him apt to do reckless things. And the most reckless is going to be firing Mueller. But we got other recklessness going on as well. It's a dangerous time, and it'll get more dangerous the closer Mueller gets. And even more dangerous, plus as the U.S. economy slows and gets in trouble again, which is imminent, it's coming. Oh, well, what are some of the early indicators of that imminent slowdown? Well, retail sales, for one, three straight months of slowdown. The last month, retail sales flat, stagnant. Retail sales is the biggest segment of consumer spending. So it's pretty important. At the same time, we see this exceptional buildup in business inventories. Well, if retail sales are slowing and inventories are building up, at some point, the inventories are going to start contracting. And that, along with retail sales, is going to drag down GDP. It may occur in the first quarter. Already the estimates are below 2% official by the Atlanta Fed. But I think they're going to go even lower still. And we could see a quarter growth of barely 1% here fairly soon. Fairly soon. At the same time, there's no wage growth. Oh, that's a big myth. We'll talk about that in more detail in a future show. And core prices. Inflation below 2% again, well below 2%. You know, there's no price pressures, which means the Federal Reserve has no justification with no wage growth and no price pressures to raise interest rates. And yet they're still talking about 3 or 4 rate hikes going on this year by the Federal Reserve. Well, why is the Fed raising rates now when inflation still isn't an issue and there's no wage growth? Why are they doing that? Well, the reason they're doing that is because they have to finance somehow $1 trillion budget deficits for the next decade, maybe even higher. Why? Because of two things, the massive tax cuts, $3 to $5 trillion, not 1.5. We talked about that on the show. And the nearly, well, actually probably $100 billion a year increase in defense spending. Well, they say 75 to 80 billion officially in the budget, but that's not counting what's off budget, which is at least another 25 billion. So we're looking at least 100 billion more a year, and it may be even more than that, and a massive $300 to $400 or $500 billion a year tax cut deficits. So, at least half a trillion dollars a year in further deficits on top of the deficits. As we said, even J.P. Morgan's estimating next year's deficit $1.2 trillion. Well, the Federal Reserve has to raise funds to pay for that. It has to issue bonds to borrowers in the U.S. and offshore. And offshore is almost half of the borrowers now to finance the deficit in order to cover that deficit. That's why they're raising rates. You see, if you raise rates, the return to buying bonds is more attractive. And that will ensure they'll be able to raise the rates. Get the financing to cover the deficit. So that's why Fed rates are rising. But as they rise, they're going to cool off retail sales even more. You know, the biggest component in this flattening of retail sales is the collapse of auto sales. That's going to continue even further. How do we explain then the fact that we get this good jobs number and consumer sentiment is up? Well, both of those are what we call lagging indicators. They're not telling you what's going to happen. They're telling you what had happened in the past. The important indicators of the future, are retail sales, business inventories, and other indicators. So, if you look at the broader picture, the U.S. economy is probably heading into some significant headwinds here. To some extent, that will be offset by this massive increase in defense spending. So the consumers aren't going to be better off. Households won't be, but the defense companies will. What about the stock market? Well, the stock market just keeps going, huh? Well, is that an indicator of good times? No. It's an indicator almost totally of stock buybacks going on. That's what's driving the stock market. It's the corporate buybacks. And why are they buying back? Because they got this huge $3 to $5 trillion corporate investor tax cut. They're taking that money, which is 10 to 31% profits increase on their bottom line. They're taking it and they're buying back their stock. And they're paying out dividends, just as I predicted they would, because that's exactly what they did under George W. Bush. They're doing the same thing. They're not bringing that money back to invest and expand production and jobs in the U.S. They're bringing it back, and they're getting the tax cut, and they're spending it on stocks. Now, studies clearly show that most of the purchases of stocks right now is corporate buybacks. And that's really been a big factor for the last 7-8 years, corporate buybacks and dividend payouts. So you got to give rich folks and investors more and more money. They get to keep more and more money so they can buy more and more of their stock to get capital appreciation and capital gains, profits, and et cetera, et cetera. It's just, it's the subsidization going on of the financial asset markets made possible by tax cuts. Previously, it was made possible by Fed low borrowing rates. Well, the Fed now has to raise rates to cover the deficit, so now the subsidization's moved to fiscal policy, tax policy. One way or another, right hand, left hand, the state subsidizes the corporate elite and their investor class. All right, so that's what's going on with the stock market. That's not an indicator of health, a healthy economy. You know, the real indicators are what's happening with consumer spending and business spending. And of course, government spending is going to, defense spending is going to make up the difference. Well, that's the old neoliberals policy mix of Reagan. Hasn't changed, except now it's Reagan on steroids, you see. Neoliberalism 2.0, as I talk about it. And we're going to see more of this. At the same time, total U.S. debt has risen from $50 trillion, total meaning government debt, corporate debt, household debt, $50 trillion on 2007 at the beginning, on the eve of the last crisis. Today, it's $70 trillion. $70 trillion. We've added $20 trillion in total debt. Half of that has been government debt, but the other half has been private debt. And mostly corporate private debt, as corporations have issued bonds when they really didn't need it because interest rates are so low and they just hoarded the cash. Or they invested it in stocks and drove up their stock prices, you see. So we're further in debt. Households are in as much debt as they were, $14 trillion, as they were in 2007. The debt problem has increased, has grown worse. Now, the debt problem, as I said many times, you know, the level of debt is not by itself a problem. So long as your income to service that debt, to pay the principal and interest, also rises. Well, real income is not rising. And at some point, the price increases on these assets are going to turn south. And when they do, the debt remains and has to be paid. And those who can't pay it, who can't service their debt, go bankrupt. And we're seeing early signs of this, corporate bankruptcies everywhere in the advanced economies. You know, we're seeing it in Europe, you know, in the UK, and in Germany, and here we got a couple bankruptcies, you know, Toys R Us and others, and I don't know about Japan and Asia. I haven't looked at that closely, but, you know, these signs of bankruptcies are, you know, the canary in the coal mine here. The worst off companies aren't able to roll over that debt, and they got to roll it over because they don't have the income, the profits, in order to pay for it, and they can't get the loans to reissue their debt, so they go bankrupt. They default. They go bankrupt. Well, watch the bankruptcy and the default rates very closely. Both consumer households and corporate, particularly those businesses that loaded up on junk debt, junk bond debt, watch it closely. That will be more canaries singing in the coal mine here once they start dropping off one by one. Right. So the total debt is a problem. Right? My book, you know, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, talks in detail about across all the advanced economies of China about this problem of debt. Now, China is attacking the debt. They call it deleveraging. They're going after those institutions, the shadow banks, that are the conduits of this debt, private debt increase. But when you go after them, you know, you raise interest rates and so forth, so they don't borrow so easy to speculate, but that slows your economy down. And China's been going flip-flopping on that issue. Do we attack the speculators and the shadow bankers and, you know, deleverage? And then we have a slowdown in the economy, or do we focus on the economy and let the speculators run amok? China's been doing that back and forth. And now China is once again trying to deleverage and take on the speculators, but it's going to slow down their economy. They're already admitting it will be 6.5% instead of 6.9% annual GDP growth rate. They're already admitting that. It's probably going to be closer to 6 officially, which means it's probably closer to 4 unofficially over there. Well, if China slows down, you know, that means global trade is going to slow down as well. At a time that the U.S. Inventory spending and retail sales are slowing down. Another reason why, we're going to have a significant slowdown, I predict, in the real economy, as, of course, the financial economy grows more unstable. In other words, the trade side of the equation is going to get weaker. Well, let's talk a little bit about trade again as a follow-on to last week. Well, you know, the news last week was the tariffs on steel and aluminum by the Trump administration, right? Well, as I said, that, you know, that's not the real focus. That is just a shot across the bow and an opening general offensive by the U.S. to change the global terms of trade in favor more of U.S. business interests. That's what that was, right? And we can see Trump backtracking and exempting people, countries from all over the map, right? Who's the biggest importers of steel to the U.S.? Well, it's Mexico and Canada. Yeah, they're the biggest importers of steel. China, no, very little. And, of course, Trump exempts Mexico and the U.S. You know, it was useful to give a warning to Mexico and U.S. now in the middle of NAFTA renegotiations, right? That's a signal that, hey, you know, if you don't change these terms more favorable to U.S. businesses here, NAFTA, you know, we're going to come at you, even though we're supposed to have a free trade or deal. We're going to come at you and impose some other kinds of tariffs on you, Mexico, Canada. Well, see, he exempted him from the steel and tariffs, but, you know, that was just a warning shot. And, of course, he's going to exempt most of Europe from it. And, okay, so he also gets a lot of steel imports from Korea and Japan. Well, you think he's going to, you know, put the screws to Korea when he needs them to deal with, you know, this maneuvering here with North Korea? No. Well, how about Japan? No, he's not going to put the screws to Japan either, because Japan is a big buyer of U.S. Treasury bonds. And we want to make sure they keep buying Treasury bonds because we got this budget deficit. It has to be financed again, right? Look, if these foreign countries, the big ones, Japan, China, and a few others that buy most of our Treasuries, stop buying or slow down even to buying a Treasury bonds, then the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve that buys and sells on behalf of the Treasury, will not raise the funds to cover the U.S. budget deficit. And that's got to be done. So, you know, they're not going to risk aggravating any country that buys significant amounts of U.S. Treasury. They're not going to do it. And that's the big stick that these other countries have, including China. Okay, you know, you want to engage in a trade war, Mr. Trump, then, you know, we'll just stop buying your bonds and good luck on financing your deficit. Well, if it comes to that, I'll tell you what's going to happen here domestically. They're going to try to make up the difference in the U.S. by really going after entitlements. In other words, Social Security and education and all the rest. They'll go after it with sharpened knives. You know, already they're talking about it, but you know, that's the excuse they'll have to really cut back, make the rest of us pay for their deficit that's caused by $100 billion a year more in defense spending and $5 trillion in business investor tax cuts. You see, that's the big cause of it. But they'll make us pay for it. So watch it. Big attacks possibly coming, bigger than they're even threatening on rolling back social programs and entitlements. It all depends how aggressive Trump gets on his trade policy here and what the response will be by those countries that buy most of U.S. debt. That's the connection. We'll see what happens. Watch it closely. talking about the trade deficit. You know, if this tariffs on steel and aluminum are only the opening shot and a warning shot, who's the real target if they keep exempting Korea and Mexico and Europe and so forth, all the others that import steel and aluminum to the U.S., if they exempt all them, who's the real target? Real target is China. This is about tariffs and an opening trade war with China, not with the rest. It's all about China. Well, look, here's why. The total U.S. trade deficit, in other words, purchases of imports over sale of exports by the U.S. last year was $566 billion. $566. Now, the U.S. runs a services surplus, not a deficit with the rest of the world, of $244 billion, which means our deficit in goods, in other words, actual products, physical products, is really $810 billion. $800 billion of things, not services, things that we buy more from the rest of the world than we sell to it. It's not 566, that's the net with the services surplus included. Okay, so $800 billion. And about $400 billion of that is with China. $400 billion. So that's the big nut that they're going after, you see. They got to crack that nut. So China is the target. And already Trump is indicating, well, he wants to see a $100 billion reduction in the deficit, goods deficit with China. Watch next week. You're going to see the focus really appear on China as the target in this, quote, trade war. It's not a global trade war. It's a trade war with China. Well, if China's already slowing down economically because it's going after shadow bankers, right? You really think China is going to cut its sales to the U.S. by $100 billion? You think they're going to do that? No, I don't think so. Well, that's what it's going to be, a fight over, and we'll see how that turns out. Now, this is not something new. As I said last week, and I'll elaborate here a little bit now, the U.S. capitalists do this periodically. Periodically, they will attempt to readjust their trade deficits with certain sectors of the global economy, other capitalist sectors, to make sure that U.S. capitalists and businesses maintain dominance and ensure that U.S. business interests continue to prevail over their foreign capitalists in terms of capturing of markets and profits and so forth, right? This occurred in 1985 under Reagan. Reagan did the same thing that Trump's doing now. You know, this Trump tariff thing and the NAFTA renegotiation and next week the attack on China here in trade, you know, this is the signal that we have another major U.S. capitalist offensive on the trade front. 1985, Ronald Reagan went after Japan and Europe, mostly Japan, much more stringent deal called the Plaza Accords, forcing in negotiations, through negotiations, forcing the Japanese to raise the price of their goods and therefore reduce their competitiveness with the U.S. And raise inflation in their domestic economy as a consequence. And as part of that, the deal was, U.S. Business interests would then be more competitive with Japan, right? And the trade deficit would decline. Well, it did. And that was part of the neoliberal offensive back in 1985. Well, it's emerging once again. But the target this time is China. Trump and the U.S. is going after China the way Reagan and the U.S. went after Japan in 1985, forcing them to sign the Plaza Accords, as they were called, and then the Europeans, right after that, forcing them to sign the Louvre Agreement, as in the museum, the Louvre Agreement. You know, that's where the negotiations were held, the Plaza Hotel in New York. That's where the negotiations were held. So, you know, the Plaza and the Louvre agreements are key to understanding this trade offensive that always occurs periodically. So U.S. multinational corporations can maintain a dominance over their capitalist competitors elsewhere in the world. And you can do this because the dollar is the trading currency, you see, gives the U.S. tremendous power. You know, 87% of all the trade is done in dollars. That's why you see countries today trying to get away from using dollars in trade. You know, Venezuela's trying to trade with India based on, you know, their currency, the rupee, Indian currency, and, you know, this cross-border south-south trade is trying to be done in other currencies. And then you got the Chinese yuan, a currency which is going to become more so, although slowly, more so a trading currency as well. But that can't change overnight, you see. So the dollar dominates in the meantime. Well, even before that, we had the same thing occur in 1971 under Nixon. This time the target were the Europeans. You know, age five primary target was Japan, today it's China. Well, in 1971, Richard Nixon introduced his new economic program, as he called it, the heart of which was to scuttle the 1944 Bretton Woods international system of trade that we created, and we dumped it, destroyed it, whenever it was useful. And Nixon said it was useful because under that agreement, the dollar was pegged to gold, $35 an ounce of gold. And because it was pegged, the Europeans, when inflation began to accelerate in the U.S., the Europeans said, hey, you know, we don't want to hold these dollars that are depreciating because of inflation in the U.S. We're going to trade them in for your gold, Uncle Sam. Huh? And, of course, the U.S. didn't want to give up its gold. So Nixon overnight said, you know, that's the end of that agreement. Unilaterally, we're breaking it. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. They broke the agreement. The dollar could not be traded for gold, and the dollar depreciated. It declined as a result. And if you lower the exchange rate of the dollar, U.S. goods become more competitive exporting, you see, and the U.S. corporations get a bigger share of the global trade pie if you can devaluate. Well, you know, when we went off the Bretton Woods Agreement in 71 and 73, negotiated the deal called the Smithsonian Agreement. You know, that's where it was negotiated. They always name these things after the locale of the negotiations. Well, at that time, the dollar depreciated. How much? How much did the dollar depreciate as a result of the Nixon move? Significantly, 22%. The dollar declines from 1971, when this was announced, to 1978 on a trade-weighted, inflation-adjusted basis. In other words, the true devaluation, by 22% against the basket of other currencies. 22%. Big devaluation. Well, that really helped U.S. corporations compete with their capitalist rivals globally, both in the U.S. and offshore markets as well. 22% as a result. of the scuttling of the Bretton-Woods international system. Now, one of the significant historic consequences of that scuttling, and in other words, breaking the relationship between dollar and gold, was that the central banks, the Fed in the lead, then had to become active in injecting money into the economy, the global economy, in order to stabilize the relationship between the currencies. This was called the managed float. You see, the dollar would float. The consequence of that I cover in my most recent book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, which fundamentally argues that what happened after Bretton Woods was the U.S. and other central banks just flooded the market with currency, with liquidity, and that fueled financial speculation. So much liquidity was injected that what you got was financial bubbles more and more everywhere. And that, of course, led to a whole host of financial bubbles in the 1980s, you know, in property markets, in junk bond markets, in northern banks in Europe, and the general crash in Japan in 1990, and then sovereign debt crises in various parts of the world, and then the Asian meltdown, currency speculation crisis, and the dot-com bubble busting in 2000, and then, of course, the housing and subprime mortgage and so forth, property markets crashing in 2008. And since then, we see stock market bubbles rising and crashing in different parts of the world, in China and so forth. Right now, we got a bubble in the U.S. Okay, and that too will crash. So that's the result of all the central banks pumping all this excess money into the economy. But that was a consequence of, in part, the collapse of Bretton Woods undertaken by Richard Nixon to increase the competitiveness of U.S. corporations vis-a-vis their European counterparts by devaluing the currency. Okay. Now, the same thing happened in the 1980s under Reagan, okay? When Reagan comes into office, what does he do? He attempts, this is part of neoliberalism, right? He attempts to bring down the inflation rate, the consumer inflation rate, which had escalated because of global oil prices mostly, into 10-12% annual rates. So that inflation caused essentially by offshore forces, the oil supplies being cut because of the politics in the Middle East, Reagan takes it out on the American consumer. He gets Paul Volcker to come in. Actually, Paul comes in under Carter, and they raise interest rates to 18%, federal funds rate, 18%, which meant the housing mortgage rates and auto rates were over 20%. Well, that just totally shut down the housing, construction, and auto markets, and we went into a deep recession in 81. But those high interest rates attracted a lot of foreign investment into the U.S. buying treasury bonds. You know, if I'm a foreigner and I can get an 18% on a treasury bond, you know, I'm going to buy that. And all that money flowed into the U.S. Okay. Of course, it crashed the U.S. domestic economy. We had a deep recession, 81, 82. But we had a lot of foreign capital flow into the U.S. Well, when that happens, you see, it drives up the value of your currency. Because to buy the bonds, the foreigners have to take their currency and buy dollars in order to buy the bonds. And buying dollars, demand increases for dollars, drives up the price of dollars, the value of the dollar. So following this 22% decline in the value of the dollar under Nixon in the 70s, we get for the first 5 years of Reagan, between 80 and 85, an escalation in the value of the dollar of 44%. 44%. Now, that makes U.S. companies less competitive. The whole effort to devalue the dollar in the 70s, which was successful, was followed by an absolute reversal of it and then some in the early 1980s. Well, Reagan was focusing on the domestic economy first, and he was allowing the dollar to rise for a while. And then in 85, it had gotten so high that Japan Inc., as they called it, was eating our exports lunch. So Reagan turns around, and actually James Baker, his main man there in his cabinet, turns around and goes after the Japanese, where we had the worst deficit. Well, the deficit wasn't caused by the Japanese being all that better at their products and selling. It was caused by Reagan's domestic policies. His monetary central bank policy of 18% interest rates that drove up the value of the dollar. The U.S. caused its own problem. But they took it out on Japan. Just as in the 1970s, Nixon took it out on the Europeans. So we got a 44% rise, but after the Plaza Agreement, it reversed again. And between 85 and 88, the dollar crashed by 33%. So we get a 22% devaluation under Nixon, a 44% hike under Reagan in his first term, which Reagan then reduces by 33% in devaluing the dollar in 1985. Actually, it was a forced revaluation of the yen, which then devalues the dollar, you see. So, you know, whenever there's a crisis, as it was in the 70s, early 70s, and in the 80s, you know, trade policy, currency policy, is an important element of their offensive there, the capitalists, U.S. capitalists, and their politicians' offensives. You know, neoliberalism is not just about attacking labor and attacking social programs and giving tax cuts for the rich. Yeah, it's all that. But writers of neoliberalism don't quite understand international economic global elements that are part of neoliberalism as well. And of course, this currency manipulation and trade wars are really a preview or a preceding move. You initiate a trade war to force your opponent to raise the value of their currency and make them less competitive. That's what it's all about, you see. Now, when Trump goes after China, what he's going to do really is there's several ways to eliminate $100 billion in the trade deficit with China. One way is to make the Chinese raise the value of their currency. That's what he's going to try to do. You know, and that will devalue the dollar in relationship to the yuan. But when they raise their currency, then they can politically say, oh, the Chinese are manipulating their currency. Well, who's manipulating currency more than the United States? Nobody. The U.S. is the big manipulator of the world when it comes to currency manipulation. And that's what's going on now. Okay, so 22% crash of the dollar in the 70s, 44% hike in the early 80s, followed by an immediate 33% crash of the dollar in the wake of the Plaza and Louvre Accords. The dollar again escalates in value in the latter half of the 1990s. Well, what's driving the dollar up? The tech boom, which begins 95, 96, technology boom. And by 2000, the dollar had appreciated again by 30%. And ever since then, the policy has been under Bush and through the Great Recession, and that was from 2001 to 2012, the dollar again was forced to depreciate by 27%. Okay. However, since 2008, 2012, the crisis period, it's again appreciated 25%. Well, they don't want that, you know. It makes U.S. corporate interests less competitive. So now what you got is Trump out there, going out there to force these other countries to raise the value of their currencies, which would lower the value of the dollar and make the dollar more competitive, right? Because there's another element comes in here, and that is, as the Fed raises interest rates, that's going to put pressure on the dollar to rise, you see? So you anticipate the Fed raising interest rates and making U.S. corporations less competitive by going after your competition elsewhere in the world and forcing them to raise their rates in anticipation of the pressure on the dollar to rise, you see? It's all part of neoliberal 2.0 strategy that's emerging under Trump. And really, it's no different than what's been done before. But once again, this is only beginning, and this tariff stuff is just an early skirmish. Tariffs on steel and auto, on steel and aluminum, early skirmish. Right? The real focus is not steel and aluminum. And of course, you know, the whole idea there is to allow steel companies, aluminum companies in the U.S. to raise their prices, which will be passed through to other companies in the U.S. that use steel and aluminum, autos and so on and so forth, passed on to the consumer, and rising prices there are going to result in job cuts as people buy less of the consumer goods that are made out of steel and aluminum, right? Job cuts. It's not going to really save jobs or increase jobs in steel and aluminum, but it will reduce jobs in other downstream industries and companies in the U.S. So this thing will have a net job loss, these tariffs on steel and aluminum, net job loss. Very interesting, isn't it? Well, it has nothing to do with jobs. It all has to do with subsidizing American businesses one way or the other, you see, and making them more competitive vis-a-vis their capitalist competition. Neoliberalism has always been not just an attack on working class and wages and standards of living for the rest of the country. You know, it's never been just that. It's always also been an element of it attacking capitalist competition elsewhere in the world. Both cases, of course, are about subsidizing corporate profits. So through trade policy, we're doing the same thing we did with tax policy. In other words, trade policy is all about subsidizing U.S. corporate profits, just as the tax cuts just passed were really about that too. $5 trillion going to give a boost to the bottom line of corporations, of 10 to 31% immediate profit boost to the bottom line. Wouldn't you like to have a 10 to 31% raise this year? Yeah. Well, that's what they're getting, 10 to 31%. You know, the capitalists are becoming so dependent on the state to subsidize their profits. They're getting lazy, you see. Instead of being able to do it themselves, through competition, they're relying more and more on the state to help them, their politician friends. That's all what all this campaign financing stuff is really about, right? We need your help more and more because we don't want to do it. It's easier to do it through politics. So we're going to make sure we elect the right people into these legislatures and at state and national level who will do the things we want and give us this $5 trillion tax cut, raise our defense spending, and engage in this trade policy that will weaken our competitors around the world as well. It's all part of a total picture, you see. Okay, so just keep in mind that the dollar devaluations and revaluations and so forth that I just indicated, and it's really what it's all about. Okay. All right. I said earlier in the show that what are some of the indicators of fragility in the global system? You know, if you want to read my latest excerpt of my concluding chapter in my 2016 theory book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, the latest fourth excerpt of that concluding chapter can be read for free. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. And the link there will take you to my website where you can read that fourth in the series. And if you haven't read the others, there's, I think, one more series coming in this. You know, I'm sharing this with my audience. You know, read how I see, if you're interested, the global fragility. Fragility means that the system is becoming more prone and sensitive to financial instability. Doesn't mean that financial instability actually happens, but it's an indicator of sensitivity and likelihood of financial instability event, you know, like what happened in 2008, which brings us to Bear Stearns' anniversary, 10-year anniversary this week of the collapse of the investment bank, the shadow bank Bear Stearns, in March 2008, a seminal event that accelerated the pace of the financial crash that led to, you know, the big events in September with Lehman Brothers and AIG and others imploding. So Bear Stearns was important. What can we learn from Bear Stearns? Well, Bear Stearns was an investment bank, meaning a shadow bank, unregulated. And because it was unregulated, it didn't have to keep any reserves. It invested everything it had. And then it borrowed as well from commercial banks to further invest. You see, the shadow banks don't keep any reserves, any emergencies, because they don't have to because they're unregulated and they weren't part of the Federal Reserve System. All right, and when Bear Stearns invested in a lot of subprime mortgages, like other investors in shadow banks did at the time, because there was great profitability there, big risk, big crash. And when those prices of subprime bonds and housing began to retreat, well, then Bear Stearns had to borrow even more money to cover the losses. Well, at a certain point, no one wanted to loan Bear Stearns any more money to cover its losses. Bear Stearns wasn't doing anything that other investment banks were doing as well, right? Well, what caused precipitated the collapse of Bear Stearns was Bear Stearns was borrowing a lot on a regular basis from J.P. Morgan, a commercial bank. And J.P. Morgan decided, we're not going to loan you anymore, Bear. And that's when other investors said, oh, JP isn't giving Bear any more money. We better take our money and run too. So you had an investor run on that bank. You see, they weren't regular depositors, you and I, investment banks. The rich folks, they invest in these investment banks because they can make bigger money, speculate on bigger money. And when that happened, when JP said, no more money, Bear really began to collapse. Its stock price really collapsed. And then, interestingly enough, the Federal Reserve, got together with JP Morgan and loaned J.P. Morgan $29 billion to buy Bear Stearns on the cheap, because Bear Stearns stock had collapsed, you know. And the question is, did J.P. Morgan really engineer this thing in the first place? Quite possibly it did. Well, they got a great deal. The Fed gave them money to buy up this competitor on the cheap. They got like a 50-story building in downtown Manhattan for $2 billion. It was worth $100 billion, you know, part of Bear Stearns' assets. Got it for $2 billion. What a steal, right? Well, this is how these finance capitalists gobble each other up sometimes. And that, of course, set in motion a fear factor, and investors and hedge funds guys, also shadow bankers, started shorting, in other words, driving down the stock of any other financial institution that had overinvested in the subprime mortgage fiasco, and including Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, started shorting all their and Washington Mutual, you know, and Countrywide, and all of those started shorting their prices. And then, of course, Lehman Brothers. And we know the rest of that history. Well, that's the history of this. Right? Now, what's significant is that we got a big deregulation going on here. Right now, the Senate further deregulates the banks that it had partially regulated in the wake of this 2008 crash. The Senate just passes a bill which exempts a couple dozen of very large regional banks from more stringent regulations. So they're freed up now, and only a very small number of banks that are really being regulated now. And they're in the process of being deregulated. The Volcker rule, which says that these commercial banks that take deposits from retail investors like you and me can't speculate directly in some of these risky investments, that's being gutted. Stress tests by the Federal Reserve are being gutted. You know, it's interesting, stress tests. You know, the Fed does it every year to say, oh, these banks are in good shape, right? You know how they do it? They tell the banks exactly what they're going to look for, so the banks can doctor up their response to the Fed, you know, in whatever areas the Fed says they're going to look for. It's a farce. It's phony. Well, the House, U.S. House of Representatives, doesn't like the Senate bill because it doesn't deregulate enough, and they're going to deregulate even more. So we got this accelerating financial deregulation going on. Same thing that happened on the run-up to 2008-09. Same thing. And we got $10 trillion more in debt, remember, on the corporate side than we had back then. And we got a guy now appointed, this guy Kudlow, appointed to be the chief economist in the Trump administration. This is the guy who forecast in late 2007 there would be no recession. Yeah, he's not really much of an economist. He's a talk show evangelist, economic evangelist. You know, and he's a supply-sider, meaning he believes this phony notion that if you give businesses and people more tax cuts, they're going to work harder and longer and invest more, and therefore the government tax revenues is going to rise. It's the biggest ideological phony notion in economics in 100 years, supply side. It didn't work under Reagan. It was used by Reagan to justify massive tax cuts for corporations and investors then, and it didn't work then, and it's not going to work again. The tax cuts aren't going to stimulate investment, just the opposite. They're going to stimulate buybacks, the stock and dividend payouts, the mergers and acquisitions.